Pseudopod, episode 134, March 20th, 2009. This week's story, Bait, by Joel Arnold. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I remain your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from a long-term Pseudopod alumni, Joel Arnold. Your narrator this week is the mighty Cheyenne Wright, whose Arcane Times remains one of my favourite webcomics, and whose artwork I, frankly, idolise. He really is that good. So, wrap up warm, check your bait, and prepare to catch something different. Because I have a story for you. And I promise you, it's true.
Bait by Joel Arnold. It was a cold January when Paul Robinson parked his flatbed pickup on the edge of Shady Lake. The ice was 10 inches thick. Plenty thick, yet it still didn't compare to the rind of ice that had settled around his heart. He let the tailgate drop, hauled out his wooden fishing shanty and slid it over the ice to a spot a good 50 yards from the other fishermen. It was dusk, and many were already leaving, their perch, walleye, and trout packed in coolers to take home to their families. He began to arrange the inside of the shanty, a homemade thing of clapboard and 2x4s. He lit a pile of pre-soaked coals in an old coffee can for extra warmth, the flame swirling for a moment like a dervish, and then settling to a comfortable glow. As he slid his styrofoam bait bucket across the shanty's floor, steam seeping from beneath the lid, he heard the crunch of cleated boots behind him. He turned. "You're getting a light start today." It was Sven Gustafsson with his gas-powered auger. His chocolate lab, Blackie, followed close behind, clumsy on the ice.
"Can I cut you a hole?"
Paul nodded. "A wide one."
"What for?" Sven smiled. "You expecting a couple of big northerns to come your way?"
"Just like a big hole is all. And keep your dog out of my bait."
"You got smelt in there today."
"Blackie loves smelt."
"Just keep him away from me tonight. I am in no mood."
Sven laughed and started the auger up, its whine accompanying the wind, the whir of the blade through the ice setting Paul's teeth on edge. The smell of gasoline and exhaust filled the air.
When Sven was done, he whistled at Blackie.
"Come on, git, before Paul here sets a hook in ya."
The dog pounced away a few feet, then stopped waiting. Sven started to leave, but hesitated. He turned to Paul, kneeling down on one leg, and pulled back the hood of his thick black parka. He cocked his head to one side, studying Paul. Paul looked up, annoyed.
"What?"
Sven turned his eyes to the fresh hole in the ice. When he spoke again, it was with a soft, quiet voice. "I just wanted to tell you how sorry I am about your son. I know you and Peg have been having a hard time of it." Paul looked out at the shanty across the lake to the far shore. The last light of the day bled through a skeletal wall of birch. He squinted at the pile of stones he placed there. "It's a hard thing," he said.
"If you need anyone to talk to..."
Sven started, but Paul waved the words away.
"I'm getting by."
"How's your wife? How's Peg been?" Paul hoped the tears he felt welling up stayed put. He cleared his throat and spat.
"Yeah, you know how it is."
Sven waited, and when Paul said nothing more, he nodded and stood, hefting the auger up with him.
"Well, if you need anything, anything at all, you know where I'm at."
"I'll be fine."
He watched Sven leave, then finished setting up the small 6x5 shelter. It was almost tall enough for him to stand up in, but not quite. Although he'd cut a 12-inch diameter hole through the top the year before so he could watch the stars through it with his boy. His boy, Jack. How many times had he been able to look at the stars with his son? Point out the few constellations he knew? Point out the ghostly strip of the Milky Way? Not enough. God damn, that was for sure not nearly enough. He heard the bark of Blackie echo across the lake, clear and sharp in the crisp January air. He leaned over the freshly drilled hole in the ice, took his old rusty skimmer, and scooped out the slush and ice chips from the surface. He shined his flashlight at the hole, a dark pupil within an iris of frozen water. How could anything live in such a place? Time for some coffee. He opened the thermos, poured some into the lid, and sipped. Too goddamn strong. Peggy never made it this strong. She made the best damn coffee in the world, just the way he liked it. But he had to make it today. He tried to remember to put less in the filter next time. Peggy. Damn. He'd get used to it, he told himself. Get used to being lonely, because you're going to be lonely a long, long time. He swallowed the rest of the coffee in the lid with a shudder and grimace. Get used to it. His son Jack had died the year before, drowned in this very lake. Only 13 years old. After it happened, Paul didn't think he'd have the stomach for fishing anymore. Didn't fish all summer, in fact. But when the lake froze up once again, he couldn't help but think about his son. And coming out here on the lake brought him that much closer. They had argued that day. Another bitter regret. Jack had wanted to go fishing, and Paul told him no. The season was already over.
Please, Dad?
It's not safe.
Can't we at least try it?
How many times do I have to tell you? They'd had some damn good times that winter out on the lake, and Paul wanted it to last as much as his son. But you can't break the rules of nature. Ice melts. It's as simple as that. But Jack didn't listen. He hopped on his bike and struggled for 5 miles over roads covered in slush and wet gravel, his jiggling rob wobbling behind him and antenna tuned into the frequencies of cold, deep water. The ice still looked strong enough on the top of the lake, even though there was not another fisherman to be found. Paul knew his son's heart was filled with such a longing, the lake, the fish luring him, that he must have ignored the telltale signs of thin and rotten ice. First was the fact that there were no shanties left on the lake, and second, there was open water along the shore in places, and surely that must have been a clear enough sign. Paul thought he had taught his boy well, taught him about the intricacies of ice, that he should never go if it's thinner than 4 inches. But apparently the pull was too great in the boy's soul. They found his mountain bike that first day. And 2 frantic days of searching later, his twins cap and denim jacket washed up on the shore, belched up from beneath the receding ice cover. Once it melted, they dragged the lake. But it was large and deep, and they had no luck of finding his body. That was one of the hardest things to deal with, the lack of closure. Paul wanted to believe that Jack was still alive somewhere, just run away, or perhaps abducted but still alive. For those are the fantasies of grown men who have lost their children. But deep in his soul, he couldn't deny the overwhelming probability that his boy still lay on the murky lake bottom, communing with the fish he used to dream about in his warm bed at home. They had had a funeral. There was a polished granite headstone in the cemetery, but Paul couldn't bear to visit it. Instead, he piled up the stones he had collected from the lake's shore and made a mound of them just for him and his son. Silly, probably, but he thought of it as a beacon that made no sense except to himself, a beacon he could focus his loss on. He started coming out to the lake again with his fishing gear in December, when the ice was first thick enough, and he'd come out most days since, even with Peggy fussing about how he should stop torturing himself. It's not going to bring him back. You don't understand, Peg.
How can you say that? How can you tell me I don't understand? He was my son, too.
but it's not about that.
It had gotten harder and harder to be with her, to come home to her after work and face her, the guilt of Jack's death like a dulled axe blade pressing slowly into his gut. If only he would have taken Jack to show him how thin the ice was. If only he would have. The list was endless. So he came out here when he could, which was most nights now after work, watching, waiting, wondering what would bite. There were times when he didn't even drop a line in. He'd just sit, hovering over the dark hole, his thermos of coffee slowly growing cold next to him. He'd sit and watch, the exposed skin on his face and neck not registering the sub-zero temperatures, his breath blossoming before him in ghostly whispers before being snatched away through the hole in the shanty's roof. He'd sit and wait, wondering at the movements he sensed not far below the surface, when the wind died to a whimper, and all he could hear was his own heart and the deep, dull crack of settling ice. He was sure he felt something stirring below him. One night, only his second night out this winter, as he sat eating a cracker and thinking about his son, he felt a tug on his jiggling rod. He jerked it back with a flick of his thick wrist, feeling the hook set. He concentrated on the hole, on the weight that bowed his rod. Must be one damn big walleye, he thought. A heavy one, with not a lot of fight in him. Began to reel in his line. He'd been using one of Jack's favorite lures, one that Jack had carved and painted himself. Using it brought Paul that much closer to his son, and now, with a big old walleye appreciating its lost son's abilities, Paul couldn't help but smile. He continued to reel the line in, hoping it was strong enough. The tip of the rod bent to the surface of the water. Paul kept turning the reel, his hands growing numb from the pressure. His head steaming with perspiration, he thought he saw something in the dark, murky water, a large shadow rising. A log? But it couldn't be a log, could it? Hadn't it tugged a bit? Played with the line at first? Could a log do that? He pulled at the rod, strained at the reel, now worried his son's lure would be lost forever in the cold depths. He squinted, thought he could see a large silhouette close below the surface. It was a familiar shape. He felt his heart in his throat, his breath spurting from his mouth in frozen blasts. My God, it can't be. But just as Paul's desperate hope turned to a longing to believe, the line snapped. He fell hard on his back, seeing real stars blur above him through the hole in the roof. He blinked and shook his head, sat up, scrambled to the hole, leaning over it until the tip of his nose touched the cold surface of the water, hoping, praying that his eyes could penetrate the impenetrable murk. He saw nothing but his own panicked face reflected back at him. He rolled over onto his side, curled his knees up to his chest, and stared at the plain wooden walls of the shanty. What had he hooked? His mind told him one thing, while his heart told him something else entirely. But that was over a month ago. Now he sat twitching his jig, wishing Sven's dog would stop its miserable barking. He wanted silence. He wanted to be able to listen, to hear the shifting subtleties of ice and water. He spent the last month wondering what had brought about that tug on his line, and it finally came to him just the night before. The lure. It had been Jack's favorite. Perhaps it still was. Paul had to find something else, another lure. He had to try again. He'd gone through both their tackle boxes, spreading the contents out on the surface of his work table at home. There was nothing else, nothing like the lure Jack had carved only the year before. What else could he use? What else would coax his son to the surface, cross through the icy threshold back into this world? The answer was simple, really. Obvious. He twitched the jig up and down, trying to entice that which he knew deep in his soul resided below the frozen surface. Something tugged hard at the line, almost ripping the pull from his hands. He fell forward hard onto his knees, the tip of the rod arched dangerously, its tips smacking the water. He hoped the line would hold, hoped the rod wouldn't snap. The bait was working. Whatever had grabbed it pulled it frantically deeper. Paul strained at the rod, staring wide-eyed at the unblinking hole. Why was the line playing out so fast? He didn't want that. He didn't want the bait to be taken like a token to whatever lair existed below. The bait was meant to be enticement, a lure to this world above.
"Don't be so greedy," Paul whispered hoarsely, struggling not to let the rod jump from his hands.
He wedged the handle between his arm and chest so that he could free one hand to grab the bait bucket. He knocked off the lid, the smell of the bait bringing fresh tears to his eyes. He reached into the warm, steaming contents and grabbed a handful of the bloody mixture. He dropped it in the hole, grabbed another handful and dropped that in too.
"Come on. There's more where that came from. Come on."
The rictus of the hole turned to bright red where the chum touched. Chucks of bait floated in the small circle of water, some of it stinging, some of it clinging to the edges. The spin of Paul's reel slowed. It stopped. There was hesitation below. Paul ignored the stinging sensation of the chum freezing on his bare hand. He cranked the reel. There was a bit of give. He slowly took in the line, grabbed another handful of bait and tossed it in the hole.
"That's right," he whispered,
his hand moving faster now on the reel.
"That's right."
It was a mad elation, an excitement filled with terror and love, his mind racing as fast as his hand. What would come of this reunion? What secrets of that strange other world would be shared? There was so much Paul wanted to tell his son. So much to catch up on, yet Paul knew that perhaps his son wouldn't be the same. The Jack he knew was already gone. This thing on his line, only the husk of a long-drowned boy inhabited by tiny worms, and instincts both primal and fierce. But he kept reeling in the line, all these emotions incendiary in his mind, all these thoughts overridden by the need, the complete and relentless need to see his son one more time. How dare he be taken from him without any warning? How dare he disappear from the face of the earth without a chance for Paul to experience one last smile, one last laugh, one last squeeze on the shoulder? How dare? He felt him rising to the surface. He felt the heavy, bloated weight nearing the lips of the hole. And the reel suddenly jammed. He tried to force it, and the handle snapped off, Paul's eyes fixed on the hole, the wind outside howling over the thin wooden walls of the shanty.
"Jack!"
he cried. He was so close. Yet the water was too dark, the chum on the surface clouding it even further. He grabbed his flashlight, a sturdy black metal one, and flicked it on, pointed its harsh beam at the hole, threw the rod to the side and lay flat on his stomach, his face hovering over the water.
"Jack!"
he called, the flashlight merely bouncing off the surface. He thrust his arm in the water, the wetness biting through his flannel shirt sleeve and into his arm. The flashlight beneath the water caused a red glow through the surface chum. He tried to scoop it away, but most of it slid back through his fingers. There was something there, all right. Something so close. Even though his hand felt like it was being jabbed with 1,000 tiny shards of glass, the water so cold it burned, he felt something brush against his fingers. Something large and solid. He yanked his hand out to free it from the flashlight.
It lay precariously close to the edge, shining sharply into Paul's eyes, but none of that mattered. He thrust his hand back into the chill of the lake, reaching blindly, his face pressed into the ice, his arm in the water up past his elbow, when he felt a hand clamp around his forearm beneath the layer of ice. He knew it was his son. He knew it was Jack. He pulled with all his strength. The fingers of his dead son were even colder than the water that cradled him. So cold, Paul felt as if all the bones in his arm had turned to ice. Jack's fingers erupted from the water, slender bone poking through loose, milky flesh. Paul pulled until most of Jack's arm had emerged. He reached fanatically behind him for the ice chisel. He needed to widen the hole. There was no way Jack could fit through. "Damn it! Hold on!" Paul said. And then there was Jack's face, rising an inch above the surface, his lips peeled back and sputtering, gurgling sounds erupting from the black of his throat, the hook that held the bait firmly set in his blackened cheek. Paul watched, listening, trying to make out the words issuing from the purple swollen tongue and chalky white chunks of remaining teeth. He listened, watched, realized his son wasn't talking at all, but rather continuing to bite at the chum that clung to the surface in a thick crimson film.
"Look at me!"
Paul lost all the feeling in his arm as Jack continued to squeeze.
"Open your eyes, boy!"
And Jack did open his eyes, the tattered lids fluttering back to reveal empty sockets. A minnow leapt free from one, only to land between Jack's gnashing teeth. Despite the horror of it, the knowledge that Jack was no longer the same boy he'd taken fishing a year ago was, in fact, a cold, rotting thing, Paul said,
"Listen, Jack. Listen closely. I love you, okay? I love you."
The words were like a torch set against the wall of ice that had built up around Paul's own heart over the past year. His free hand brushed across the ice chisel behind him. He grabbed it and began stabbing at the ice around the edge. He would free him. Free Jack. Pull him up out from the cold waters of death and bring him into the world of the living. The ice chips flew. Wasn't it worth it? So what if Paul had cheated a little? So what if he had tricked Jack to the surface with the only lure he knew would work? That was the sign of a good fisherman. It was the sign of a good father. The one thing that would bring Jack back to him. And it had worked, hadn't it? Wasn't it worth it to see him once again? A reunion of father and son, where love had coaxed a dead, rotting thing from the bottom of a deep, dark lake. A boy's true love. The love a boy has for his mother. The door to Paul's shanty burst open. Blackie bound in, his loud barks ringing sharp and painful in Paul's ears. Jack's hand loosened its grip. Paul tried to grab hold, but the dog jumped between them, lunging for the worm-riddled flesh of Jack's wrist. The dog missed, kicking the black metal flashlight into the hole. Jack slipped once again beneath the surface. The flashlight caught on the protruding bones of his ribcage. Paul watched the red glow diminish into the depths. His eyes, wide with loss. He didn't hear the crunch of Sven Gustafsson's cleated boots behind him. Sven's admonishment of Blackie. Didn't hear Sven gasp at the stink of the open bucket of bait. "What the hell is that?" Sven asked. The red glow of light was barely visible now. Paul reached into the ice hole and touched his fingertips to the water's bloody surface. "What's a wedding ring doing in your bait?" Sven asked. The retreat of the flashlight's glow stopped. Barely visible. A beacon to the bottom of Shady Lake. Paul looked at it with longing. He imagined himself going in after it. Now his son, the fisherman. The flashlight. His lure. There was no way he could fit through the hole. He'd have to wait. He finally noticed Sven behind him, heard him puking on the ice. He'd have to wait until March, April at the latest, until the ice had grown thin and rotten. Wait until there was no one around, no one to drag him kicking and screaming from the pool of the lake. The pool of his son. Paul stood, the bucket that contained what was left of Peggy still steaming. He picked up the ice chisel, turned to Sven as Blackie barked at him, the choppy breath of the dog rising in small bursts through the 12-inch hole in the roof. He could wait. He lifted the ice chisel in the air and brought it down hard, again and again until there was only the barking of the dog. And soon after that, only the sound of Paul's labored breathing and the sound of blood dripping over the hole's edge into chilled water.
Picture the scene. It's about 18 years ago, and I'm reading a copy of a comics magazine that was black and white, very good, lasted about 4 issues, and whose name completely escapes me. There's an interview with Duncan Fragredo, who at that point was the artist on the Kid Eternity miniseries that, if I remember correctly, was written by Grant Morrison. Fragredo's a great artist, by the way, and this series is some of his best work. There's a passage from the interview and a series of panels from the graphic novel, which, by the way, I have yet to actually read, that years later is still seared into my mind. He mentions how he's been experimenting with filming himself and drawing some of the mannerisms, and this is illustrated by 3 panels of a character walking onto a stage behind a mic, rolling his sleeves up, gathering himself and saying, "I've been thinking a lot about death recently." I haven't, but I have a deep abiding love of stand-up comedy and the iconography of stand-up comedy, and that moment and the anticipation that lies behind it has been preying on my mind recently. It's the moment before we say something, before we discover something. The moment where the world swings with you as its fulcrum, where everything changes and the only thing you can do is hang on and wait for the scenery to settle. 2009's been quite a hard year so far. It's not been an unrelenting horror fest like 2007 was, but it's just been lots of work, lots of change, lots of growth. As I write this, we're about 7 weeks in, and right now I've got more responsibility, more difficult choices made, and more to make than I had done at the end of 2008. I like to think of this as both a sign of my own growth as a person, note I do not say grown up, but that's a rant for another time, and that, like I say, this is probably going to be a hard year. There's dead wood to shift, stuff to be done, and as is my wont, I've been talking to my best friend about this. As is her wont, she summed it up better than I ever could, in just 4 words. This is your year. And you know what? As usual, she's right. It is. This is the year I stop looking and I start doing. The year I finally, hopefully, let go of the wound I've carried since I got laid off 3 years ago. This is the year, hopefully, I realise that the gap between the person I think I am and the person I am is actually pretty small. It's not going to be easy, that's clear, even now, but what it is going to be, for the most part, is fun. And this job is one of the reasons why. So thanks for listening. I don't know what's under the ice, but I'm willing to bet it's distinctly less undead than what Joel describes here. So buckle up, stick with us, and oh, donate some money, please. We rely on your donations to pay our authors, cover our hosting costs, and ensure that the pseudopod uranium mine buried deep beneath the Atlantic... Oh, damn. Forget that last part. Seriously, forget it. Return to your lives, citizens. Forget. Forget. Instead, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. You can't see, but I'm saluting those of you who do right now.
This is editor Ben Phillips with some news I'm very excited about. Today's author, Joel Arnold, a man who at this time has sold Pseudopod more stories than any other, and I dare say many of our absolute best at that, has finally released a print anthology with Sam's Dot Publishing. It's called Bedtime Stories for the Apocalypse. It's got 9 stories you've never heard here, and it's available now online. We'll put a link in this show's notes at pseudopod.org. Check it out.
Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod's told you before, don't confuse them with facts.